this is Meg Malone, the Vermont Edition digital producer, and you're listening to the Vermont Edition podcast. This episode has been edited for clarity and brevity. Happy listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. If you're watching the news or if you're active in social media at all, you've no doubt been hearing about the massive groundswell of personal stories sparked by the outing of Hollywood mogul Harvey Weinstein as an alleged serial harasser and abuser of women. The news sparked a cascade of women and some men telling their own stories and expressing frustration about a pervasive culture of misogyny and a toleration of behavior by men towards women. Certainly, abuse can go the other way as well and cross all kinds of gender lines. But the system that people are so accustomed to and frustrated by is one where men hold a cultural, physical, perceived, and often professional power over women. Today on the show, we're going to talk about why this is so and where we go from here. How do we take responsibility and control as women and men for our culture? How do we raise our children to be better? What role do men play in acknowledging their complicity or their actively harassing behaviors and take action to change? We really hope this hour can serve as a community gathering place for a helpful conversation. Let me introduce our panel for the show today. Autumn Spencer is a writer and comedian. She writes a column for Kids VT and is a regular host of The Moth in Burlington. Autumn, it's nice to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Jessica Leahy is a teacher and writer. She's the author of The Gift of Failure, How the Best Parents Can Learn to Let Go So Their Children Can Succeed. We don't have Jessica yet. She will be with us in just a moment. Mark Nash is a psychotherapist and former director of the Vermont Stage Company. And luckily, he is in the studio, so I know he's with us. Mark, it's a pleasure to have you on the program as well.
Thanks, Jane.
So I'd love first just your reflections on, you know, why you think right now this is a moment that has attracted so much attention and such, you know, not activism exactly, but so much personal outpouring from so many people, women and men, but Autumn, especially women sharing their own stories. And I, you know, what are you thinking about how this has all been unfolding?
Obviously, I think it's really important. Alyssa Milano was the celebrity who tweeted, share your story and hashtag me too. And that really took off, obviously. And I went from Twitter and to Facebook, and then I started seeing it all come up in my own timeline, which as a woman and having had these experiences myself, but seeing all of the posts in the timeline, I mean, my whole timeline was me too. I think that had such an impact on people. On the other hand, as has been written often about Weinstein in the industry, is that everybody knew. It was somewhat shocking to see all the Me Toos, and yet everybody knows. So I think that's one of the big takeaways from all of this is we're sharing it, and we already knew.
Yeah, and one of the writers who I follow on social media, Ashley C. Ford, tweeted out, and I'm going to read her tweet so that I don't misquote her, and she said, "I don't think every woman or even most of the women who wrote Me Too did so to convince men that sexual harassment or assault happens a lot." And she went on to say she thinks most women and most men know that it happens. So it wasn't an idea that you had to convince everybody that this was out there because, as you said, Autumn, everybody knows.
Everybody knows.
So then what's the power of Me Too?
The visual, I think. To some extent, the visual, just the timeline full of Me Toos. And it gives you pause. You have to stop and consider. And I think that men know as well. And I'm hoping that there's an introspection there. Also, the impact of that visual hopefully instigates some introspection. So coming together, the sharing, and you know, we all know, everybody knows, but there is something in saying me too, and then your girlfriends are saying me too, and you know, and even people you're thinking, oh really, them too, but you know.
I want to take a moment to point out as well, as this Me Too movement has developed and grown, there's also been some reporting and some acknowledgement that actually didn't start with Alyssa Milano. A decade ago, a black woman named Tarana Burke founded the Me Too movement, which is exactly in the same vein. It's for women to talk to other women, to acknowledge with other women sexual harassment and abuse. And so, you know, this iteration of it and this social media movement was sparked by Alyssa Milano's tweet, but really we should be giving credit to Tarana Burke for founding a movement with resources and all kinds of things over a decade ago on that. Mark, what are you thinking?
It may be that we all knew, we meaning men, but we don't have to confront it day after day after day in our regular lives. And so for me, when I saw the Facebook feed start to fill up with the Me Toos, it's a jolt. It's an important jolt to say, oh, yeah, it is happening to every one of my friends. And I think it's going to make it a lot harder to ignore, a lot harder to be complicit, and maybe even spur men into action, because we're the ones who are going to have to do something about this.
You're very socially active, very politically active. Did this jolt you, even as someone who I don't mean to put words or IDs on you, but I think of you as somebody who thinks of himself as progressive and politically active and active in social justice?
Yeah, I came to social justice actually relatively late. I was in the entertainment industry for a long time, and just as a side note, I was shocked but not surprised by the Weinstein revelations. But I left Vermont Stage Company 5 years ago and went into the mental health field, and that's where I really started to connect with social justice movements. And so I think I'd gotten more aware in the last few years, and my primary area of concern has been sexism and misogyny. But even as someone who was involved as much as I have been, seeing it show up on person after person after person, and people that I know and people that I've known for a long time and wouldn't maybe have guessed, was still pretty jolting.
Jude is on the line with us from Montpelier. Hi, Jude. Go ahead.
Hi, Heather. So I'm a first-time caller. I love the show. I was going to say, I was jolted into realizing, perhaps even smugly, because I consider myself well-informed and intelligent, and then I realized why I'm interested in listening to the show tomorrow, that nonetheless, I definitely am a victim myself, although I don't like to be a victim, and that in this case, I would never mention names, but it's definitely someone well-known in our community and in the VPR family that I felt changed me forever in terms of the abuse that was, you know, something that I hadn't even recognized I was had changed me so negatively. And it sort of jolted me that way, just to realize how we always think it's the other guy or the other woman. How could we let that happen? But it's insidious, and especially when someone's a major member of a community, you know, in a well-recognized way. And this guy's, you know, definitely loved and well-known around Vermont. So that's why I'm especially interested in the show. It sort of snuck up on me that I myself was a bit of a hypocrite.
So, Jude, when all of this started pouring forward, when women especially were writing Me Too and sharing their stories, it reminded you of your own experience? I mean, this was sort of a surprise to you to realize, oh, yeah, Me Too?
Well, yes, because I'm not normally a judgmental person, but I was very interested in the show and very agitated by the subject, and I've been keeping up with it for some reason. And then it just suddenly, you know, get a wham, bam, right back at me saying, wait a minute, you know, don't be so easy to judge, quick to judge, because what happened to me very locally over the course of 6 months with someone in the VPR family has fundamentally, as a middle-aged woman who considers myself very well-informed and sophisticated, has fundamentally changed and forever taken something from me. And so I realized, aha, so that's how it happens. And I wouldn't say anything because it's, you know, in the community and someone who is in a position where he has a lot of social, and he's a great, you know, figure, good person in terms of what he does for the community. But it's also not always so easy to see, I guess is what I'm saying, because it's so easy to judge other women. And then until we realize, well, wait a minute, you know.
Yeah, Jude, I really appreciate you sharing your perspective and then that wake up, you know, that feeling of like, oh my goodness, yeah, me. And, you know, that has certainly happened to me, Autumn, you know, that idea of, oh, well, that doesn't apply to me. I haven't, oh, wait a minute.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that you experienced, that reminder? You know, I think it does become so commonplace in many ways. And as I tweeted several days ago, I don't know any women who have never experienced this, who have made it to adulthood without harassment in some form and of varying degrees of problematic.
Yeah, I had the same thought. When I was going through the Me Toos in my timeline, I thought, who hasn't? But I do think that's a really important point that Jude is making,
because I do think what happened for some people is they were seeing the Me Toos. Some women are seeing the Me Toos and thinking, oh, wait a minute. And I even read a status of a woman who reviewed, I think, probably reviewed with some friends, hey, I want to check in with you and see what you think about this thing that happened to me. And I think that's common. I think it's common, not because we're not clear if it was harassment or assault or abuse or not, but because part of being harassed and part of being assaulted is believing that it's your fault and taking it on as your own and thinking or making it okay for the person who assaulted you. One of the experiences that I had, it was a week before I sat in my driveway and somebody said something maybe on the radio or a song or whatever it was and just realized that a week ago this thing had happened. And it wasn't until, you know, and I think I knew, but there was a part of my brain that was like, we're going to put that away, or we're going to make it okay for that person, or we're not going to talk about it, or maybe it wasn't bad enough, or maybe you said something, or what if you're found out? What if you say this is what happened to me? And then the person says, well, what did you say? You know, and then you think, oh, it is something I did, or worse yet, in the Donna Karen vibe, what were you wearing? So I think that that's part of the wake up for the Me Too with the Me Too impact is that a lot of most women, I would say every woman, as you said, we have these sort of files of all of these instances, not just one, but all of these instances across lifetimes. And we're sort of taking them out and going, yeah, that's what that was, mm-hmm. You know, and it wasn't my fault. And maybe the Me Too movement is a moment to be able to say, it's not our fault. It's not something we said or did.
I want to invite our other panelists into the conversation. We have her on the line now. Jessica Leahy, again, a teacher and writer and author of The Gift of Failure, How the Best Parents Learn to Let Go So Their Children Can Succeed. Jess, it's nice to have you on the program. I'd love for you to share your reflections on just your reaction to what's been happening in our country and beyond now in the wake of these Weinstein revelations.
Well, thanks so much for having me on. I actually, my Facebook status read Me Too at one point. I think I tweeted Me Too as well in response to one of the early invitations to sort of speak out. And, you know, it's definitely not something I talk about very often. I've been thinking a lot about sort of if someone said, ask me to outline specifically why I said Me Too, I realized that there's so many different moments that I could have answered Me Too that it was sort of difficult to pick. And I really like what the caller just said, that it's a moment for us to all sort of reflect on why we don't say anything. And one of the things that I've been thinking about a lot recently was I was in charge of hiring an assistant for my boss, for the person that I was no longer going to be working for. And I had interviewed a whole bunch of different candidates, and people from the office had been looking in on who I was interviewing, and a whole bunch of men from the department really wanted me to hire the prettiest one, and they were really vocal about that. And I protected the assistant's candidates from that because I felt like that was sort of part of my job, was to protect this younger woman from the pressure to hire her because she was the prettiest one. And what was so interesting is that she was the most capable one, and I wanted to hire her, but I also felt like, oh man, should I hire her? Because she'll be coming into an environment where people have felt free to weigh in on who's the most attractive candidate. So, you know, for me, it was a situation I never should have been put in the first place. And while the sexual harassment wasn't about me directly, it took up my energy for a week, you know, to try to figure out how to best handle the situation. So it definitely counts on one of my Me Toos, even though it wasn't about me. It was about someone else that I felt like I had a duty to, I had to deal with the issue, and I had a duty to protect this woman. So, you know, there are all sorts of forms of Me Too, and while I have plenty of the direct ones, there are indirect ones as well that I think are kind of interesting to think about.
Jessica, in a situation like that you bring up, you know, that question of the power dynamic or our culture comes up too, because I can imagine a scene in which an office environment, the women still feel free to comment on, you know, a pool of male candidates like, that guy is really good looking. Is there a difference when it is done in the way that you describe it from when it's women saying that about men? You know, is there a difference because of a power dynamic or because of a culture, or is it a problem no matter what?
Well, I would love to comment on that, you know, from my own experience, but I've never had the experience of a bunch of women coming to me and saying, oh, pick him because he's the cutest assistant. It's just never, you know, that's never happened to me. You know, what has happened to me is, you know, ranking of various females in my, around me, that seems to happen all the time. So while I'd love to weigh in on the, you know, the opposite side of it, it just doesn't seem to happen as often. So,
Mark, what do you think?
I think that while perhaps it's not as egregious, it's perhaps not a good idea in general to objectify people based on their appearance.
But why is it not as egregious?
Because of the power differential. There's no way that kind of ranking or that kind of ogling is going to have the same effect on a man as it is on a woman.
Let's go to Terry, who's on the line with us from Brattleboro. Hi, Terry. Go ahead.
Hi, Jane. Yeah, this is a slippery slope. I feel I need to bring up the fact that it's not just other men that enable these powerful men, but also a very specific class of women who are usually have the social status and education that will also align themselves with the men and criticize, blame, or even demonize these other women. And I'm in my 60s, and it's no deep, dark secret about the womanizing, but what continues is a certain class of women. And with Hillary, I know so many women I know that were so disappointed that she wasn't elected, but that was a classic example. There's a certain class of women, either educated or social status or both, who can reach out to women in a third world, which is wonderful, but not women of their own, you know, country. And at my age, I find it much easier to communicate with my blue-collar and middle-class women friends than upper-class women, which hadn't been so much a problem. I think it's exacerbated. But my point is, in order for our society to become more egalitarianism, I firmly believe Western women need to get out of their comfort zones and communicate more with each other and reach out more. Tweet.
Terry, I appreciate that comment, and we're going to pick up that thread, because that question of, okay, where do we go from here, and what's the responsibility of men and women if we want to see change? How do we do that? How do we make that happen? How do we raise children beyond just what we teach our children? You know, how do we raise them inside of a culture where this has been acceptable for so long and is just such a part of the fabric? I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. We're talking today about the Me Too movement. We're talking about sexual harassment and abuse, the whole spectrum. We're talking about women who feel like, well, maybe I don't have a role in speaking up because I haven't been raped, but then who realize I have been a victim of harassment. I've been a victim of misogyny. We're talking about men who feel complicit, are complicit, trying to figure out what their role is in this, and men who have also been victimized. I don't want to minimize that experience of men or people who identify in whatever way that victimization does not know gender barriers. But we're talking mostly about a culture, a system, a structure. We're talking today with Mark Nash, Jessica Leahy, and Autumn Spencer, and with many of you. And Autumn, Terry was talking just before the break about this idea that a certain class of women, as she puts it, either perpetuate or allow this to continue or have difficulty speaking up and standing up for other women?
I don't think it's so much about it being a particular class of women as it is about programming and the programming that all women receive and how misogyny is internalized. As is, you know, racism. We internalize these things, and so as women, we sometimes and can help perpetuate the culture
You know, it's that sort of thing of like, you know, growing up, I didn't have any girlfriends. I was friends with all the dudes. I only had guy friends because girls are so dramatic, or girls are this, or girls are that. You know, and that, you know, that's the message that we get very early on and carries through in different ways in our lives. And I think that there's a sense of, if we behave more like men, or if we can get the men around us to like us, then that's the thing that's important. And so we participate in the misogyny as a way of getting approval from the men around us. And that perpetuates the culture, of course, because if you're not down with a joke, or you're not sort of laughing along with the rating of the new hire, you know, then what, are you uptight? Are you a nag? Are you, you know what? And so we have this, we've been programmed to think that among the most important things in our lives is that we're accepted and by men, and that men like us, and that we're not overly offensive or edgy or hard to be around, that we're likable, and not so much are we worthy because we think we're worthy, but are we worthy because the men around us have assigned worth and think we have value.
Well, or the question of getting ahead. I mean, that idea of your own, not only how you value yourself, but how you try to think about what your career goals are, or what your social goals are, and how can you maneuver within a system that's built that way.
And you're making decisions. Women are making decisions along the way. If I do this, I'm definitely not going to move up or move along or continue to work in this place. But that's not my truth. But it is how I could maybe get a raise. And if I speak my truth, or I am my truth, then I'm not going to have that job, or I'm not going to get that raise. And then how do I have an influence? You know, even then, you know, if I could have this voice or have that role or have that position, you know, even though I might have had to play along to get it, well, then I'll have a position and a voice, and then I can do something. Versus if I don't play along and I don't get it, then where am I? Then where does that leave me?
Yeah. But then you get it and you think, well, now I can't speak out. Now I've done it. Mark, I see you nodding. What are you thinking?
It's a real catch-22. And the thing that August mentioned that sort of resonated for me was this idea of going along. And that, for me, dovetails with the idea of women having to do most of the emotional labor in a relationship. And if a woman is upset, she's told she's too emotional, or that she's overreacting, or she needs to calm down, which is a phrase that is almost guaranteed to get the opposite of the intended reaction. And if a man is upset, well, that can feel pretty threatening. And so it's a woman's job to make nice and to make sure that the man doesn't feel like he's done something wrong, even though he has done something wrong.
Can I jump in here,
Jane? Yes, of course, Jess.
It's really funny you say that, because a friend of mine who happens to be a reporter at a national magazine or a national newspaper just posted a text exchange. It was a public post between his daughter and someone she used to date, and the daughter was just texting about the fact that she was hiking, and the person she was that she used to date asked if she was hiking in a bikini, and the person she was texting with asked her to turn the camera around and take a picture of herself in a bikini. And she said, what the heck are you talking about? Are you harassing me? And his response was, oh, sheesh, come on, don't overreact, girl power stuff. And, you know, that's the sort of what we're running up against, this catch-22 that was mentioned, is, you know, if women push back and say, you know, don't talk like that, and then, you know, the response you often will get is, oh, my gosh, you're overreacting. And then if we don't push back, then down the road the response we get is, why didn't you say something? And so that catch-22 is sort of an impossible bind to be put in. And, you know, especially when you then, bring the power dynamic into it, you know, once women feel like they're in a position of power to say something, maybe time has passed, and then the criticism is, well, you should have said something at the time. Maybe at a time when women felt like they were in a position of weren't in a position of power and needed to wait a little while until they had that ability to say something. So there really is no winning right now in terms of the accusations that have been coming up in the media are being addressed. It's either overreaction or it's too late.
Yeah, or you know, I'll also bring up the idea of self-preservation and self-care, and right. and you know, especially in sexual assault, mm-hmm. that this idea that you know you owe the rest of the world something when you know I think we can all agree that self-preservation and self-care is pretty important in that moment, whether you choose to come forward or not.
Well, and I'd love to bring up the position of teachers. As a teacher myself, I mean, I think this is an incredibly important time for teachers in terms of you know, finding ways to teach about this in a way that's sensitive, but a lot of teachers are really afraid of talking about sexual harassment because it's such a rife topic for people to get upset and for parents to get upset about the conversations that are going on in school. But as teachers are incredibly powerful on Twitter, I don't know if you know this, but as a profession, teachers are the largest users of Twitter. It's been fascinating to watch discussions on Twitter with teachers about how exactly to approach this topic with their students because it, you know, many of them feel like it's an incredibly important topic to address and to model the right sort of responses to accusations of harassment, but at the same time, it's an incredibly explosive topic to bring up in a classroom.
Well, let's go to some of our callers on some of these questions. Omara is calling in from Morrisville. Hi, Omara.
Hi.
Go right ahead.
So I'm calling that actually with a topic that fits into what you guys were just talking about. I had an experience as a young child in middle school of a boy during health class snapping my bra and making a comment to him out loud kind of so the whole class could hear me. And then the health class teacher sent me out of the room without knowing what the situation was at all. And so I feel like as young girls, we're kind of taught from a young age, maybe not to stand up for ourselves or what you guys are saying. Just if you say something, then you're the squawker or you're just not taught to really stand up for yourself. So then we learn from a young age that it's not an appropriate thing to do instead of learning that what's happening to us is actually what's inappropriate. So I think that girls from a young age should be taught when something's inappropriate, something inappropriate's happening to them, that we need to stand up for ourselves and say something and
be supported in that.
Empower them.
Yeah, Omara,
exactly.
Thanks for that. Let me take a few more calls here, and then we can sort of swirl around this discussion. Melissa is on the line with us from Montpelier. Hi, Melissa. Go ahead.
Hi. On a similar vein, I think that one of the things would be important in raising girls now is to help our daughters and help our friends' children see that when I found that growing up and going through being in early workplaces and things, men feel that in doing something harassing, that they're giving you a compliment. And we have been taught since the time we could walk that if a male gives you a compliment, the proper response is to say thank you. And so there's a confusion in all of us because on one hand, we're supposed to feel good because they're complimenting the way we look. They're complimenting the way we make them feel. And we're supposed to, because we're trained to do that, we're supposed to feel that's a good thing. That's the right thing to have happen. But conflicting, we turn away from that and we walk down the hallway and we think to ourselves, there was a sense of ridicule there. There was almost a challenge in that. There was almost a challenge. Do you dare say something to me? Most of the time, if you look at men who are harassing you, there's a smugness and a kind of a disagreeable look on their face that is challenging you almost to say something. And if you back down, it's kind of the worst sort of feeling. So in raising daughters, I think we need to start at the very bottom and teach them that the way we look is not what we're based on. And if someone says something about the way we look and it feels like it's a harassment, that it's not a compliment and it's not good.
Melissa, thank you. One more here from Mike calling in from Cornwall. Hi, Mike, your thoughts.
Yes, thank you, Jane. The boys learn the language and behavior of misogyny for the most part in school, and yet we don't have any real anti-harassment or anti-misogynistic programs, any training for teachers or coaches, anything that really assists the educational professionals in how to address this. So what happens is we get that kind of behavior is condoned in sports teams and in other settings. We need some real directed training for all of the people involved if we're going to really address the culture of misogyny in our society.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Today we're talking about the Me Too social media movement, also where we go from here, what we do about misogyny, about sexual abuse and harassment in our culture. We're talking with Mark Nash, Jessica Leahy, and Autumn Spencer, and hearing from many of you out there as well. Our number is 800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or continue the conversation online. Go to vpr.net, click on Vermont Edition. You'll find a whole comment section there. B. Fryer says, I'm interested in the silence and defensiveness of men around this. Some are speaking up and owning their participation in this and doing the right thing. Others are hitting back. K.M. Brown says, I was shocked at the number of people, especially women, who were blaming Weinstein's continued behavior on the fact that early victims didn't speak up. Allison wants to remind us that women don't owe anyone their story. Please remember to discuss this during your show today. Caitlin says men need to take the initiative to end men's violence against women. And Ed says one of the women who's unwilling to look at or talk about or affirm these near universal experiences is my mother and others in her generation. When I told her what happened to me, a female, when I was 5 years old, she acted like I had slapped her in the face. This sets up a lifetime expectation, doesn't it? That expectation, no one will protect you but yourself. Don't tell others lest they be insulted or made to feel uneasy. And give men enough of what they want without giving up too much. Be quiet. Be pleasing. Lots to discuss today. We were talking a little bit about children and what they learn and how young you learn about your place in this society. Jessica Leahy, what do you think about how we can better teach boys and girls about how to treat each other with respect and how to stand up for ourselves?
You know, it's, for me anyway, it starts in the classroom, you know, really with the small things that aren't even about this sort of sexual harassment. It has to do with treating each other with respect when we're speaking out in class, when kids are speaking out in class, you know, not doing that rolling your eyes when someone is saying something that you disagree with, that kind of thing. And then also, you know, I do a fair amount of just sort of keeping an eye on making sure that girls don't feel like, don't do a lot of that, oh, here, I have something to say, but it's probably stupid, and I talk to them about that afterwards and say, you know, this, you know, you're better than that, and don't let people make you think that's something appropriate that you can say about yourself, and not letting the boys take over during a discussion. It's sort of that constant, you know, making sure that the conversation is supportive for everyone. At the same time, you know, there have been plenty of times when I've had to have conversations behind closed doors with kids who have either felt like someone has been overtly sexual about them, and having those conversations with kids gets really dicey really fast, especially in public schools where, you know, so much of those conversations are, you know, everyone's worried about being sued over a conversation with a kid. So it's a really scary space to be in when you start talking about anything having to do with sexuality with kids. And it's usually something that, you know, you go to the administration and you say, I have to have this conversation. How do I protect myself during this conversation? It's a really hard thing to do.
Shannon is calling in from Fairfax. Shannon, jump in here. What are you thinking about?
Hi. I just want to say that I have three daughters, and my oldest is in middle school. And what she's facing right now is a lot of girls and boys are becoming interested in each other. And she often, you know, will talk about that. And what I always tell her is that this is your time now. And I try to keep drilling that in her head so that she feels empowered as a young woman. And she'll continue to feel powerful as a woman so that as she grows up, it's not uncommon to hear that this is your time. You have the control over your life and where you want it to go. And so I'm very much, you know, encouraged with how she handles certain situations at such a young age, and I can see her power coming through.
Shannon, bravo for teaching your daughters about holding their power. You know, I even at now close to 40, struggle with that idea of feeling power, of not feeling like I need to make everybody feel happy all the time. And you know, certainly at 16, 17, 15, that was something, you know, that idea of needing validation and wanting to be popular was even more powerful. Autumn, what do you think about raising kids?
I agree that it has to happen in school. I also think that it really starts at home, and it has to happen at home, and it has to happen every day. I think our kids are getting this programming out in the world, and so when they come home to us, there's a daily deprogramming that has to happen about the messages that were received throughout the day. And I think that starts early. I was really surprised. My daughter is 13 and in eighth grade, and I have continued to be surprised that there aren't having specific conversations as a class in any of the classes in any specific way where it's the conversation is open. Let's talk about how we treat women. Let's talk about how we treat girls very specifically, very directly. And I think that it's on the parents to make sure that's happening. And to take it a step further, I think it's specifically on, you know, the parents of young boys, and to take it another step further, it's on the parents of young white boys who are born to no fault of their own into unbelievable privilege, and I think we have a bit of an echo chamber. Maybe this is what Terry was talking a little bit about, is we have a bit of an echo chamber, particularly in Chittenden County, and I know listeners are everywhere, where you have a lot of, you know, well educated people who identify as progressive and liberals, and take for granted that there will be an education around misogyny and racism, and take for granted that because they consider themselves to be progressive thinkers and liberal thinkers, that their children will get those messages and also grow up to be. And it's been what's been probably most shocking to me, you know, as an adult, are the number of people who identify, who are well-educated and articulate and considerate and thoughtful people, and identify as open-minded and concerned about these things, you know, who in a party setting will approach a grown woman and make an entirely unsolicited and often gross comment about that person. And so then I'm thinking, okay, that's the message your sons are getting. So are you also having a conversation like, let's talk about how we treat people. Let's talk about how we treat women. And I think that happens at school and it happens at home. And I also think there's got to be this other conversation about, you don't get to touch my body ever. And you don't get to make comments about my body ever. Ever, unless you asked and I've said, okay, I want to hear what you have to say, which is unlikely. I'm going to say, I don't want to hear what you have to say.
Or don't touch me.
You know, so the bra snapping and all of those, the paper clips down the cleavage and all of those things, you know, that behavior when seen in a classroom, it should be stopped and called out. And like, this is how we're training and programming kids to harass and accept harassment.
Yeah, and then we hear from people like Omara who say, you know, my teacher called me out of the room when I spoke up for myself. And you know, I think it's, as Jessica said, very difficult for teachers, especially in a litigious society, especially in public schools, where, you know, you have to be so careful. And so it's within all of this structural and cultural system that we're trying to operate. Mark, I don't want to curtail your ability to talk on this, but I also want to make sure we address this question of you know, what's the responsibility of adult grown men now? And Steve wrote on our website to say, I'm tired of being called misogynistic just because I'm a man. For every Harvey Weinstein or Bill Clinton, there are thousands of men who treat their wives, girlfriends, female coworkers, and neighbors with respect and dignity. So what's the role of men who aren't treating people with dignity, but even the men like Steve who say, I'm not the problem?
Okay, Steve, you're not the problem. Are you part of the solution? It's very easy to become defensive as a man. I get it. We get scared. We think that because a woman is angry about a person, we think that they might turn around and be angry at us. Okay, that's part of that's the discomfort that we'll have to live with for a while until this gets corrected. And the best way to start that correction, the one thing men can do is listen. Just start listening. And listening without denying that bad things are happening, listening without dismissing them, and listening without defensiveness. And if you want to talk, I got two phrases. I'm sorry. As in, I'm sorry this happened to you, or I'm sorry that I did it, and I get it. Empathy and compassion goes a long way.
But then what? You know, and then what when, you know, a woman says to you, don't patronize me. I get that you're listening, but I need more.
Okay. So check your own behavior. Reflect. See if the way you're treating people, women in your workplace, for instance, is that the way that you would treat a relative, somebody that you cared about? Check your own belief systems. Do you believe that women are in any way inferior? Do you use slurs that suggest that women... Men call men a lot of awful things, and it's usually about questioning their masculinity, which suggests that femininity is somehow worse. And then stand up. There are a couple of phrases we could all get really familiar with, like, that's not cool, or that's a really lousy thing to be saying about that person. And so there are very direct actions that we can take. Start reading feminist literature. Start following feminist bloggers. Vote.
Yeah, there are whole worlds on Twitter, if you're active on Twitter. Yeah. You know, whole worlds of activism that may not be part of your general sphere or your experience that, at least for me, I have found incredibly eye-opening. Jess Leahy, what do you think?
Well, as I was going to say, as the mother of sons, you better believe that this has been something we've been talking about. You know, do you ever see your friends talking about women in ways that maybe aren't appropriate? Or even just saying, how do your friends talk about, you can do this without a without being loaded. How do you and your friends talk about girls? How do you and your friends talk about women? And then just bringing up, well, what do you think is appropriate to say about women and what do you think is not appropriate to say about women? And from a very young age, I mean, there are a lot of people out there that are, you know, really interested in saying, oh, my kid would never. Well, and that's true. When they're very, very young, maybe they never would. But at a certain point, you know, kids are extremely susceptible to getting sucked into whatever conversation is going on with their peers. Peer pressure is a very real thing, especially having to do with language and sort of the tone of a discussion. And so getting kids used to identifying problematic language from a really early age is extremely helpful, because then at the very least, when the kids are young or if they're feeling pressured and don't feel like they can speak up, at the very least they can question what they say themselves. And then teaching them to stand up for women, you know, would you stand up for your friend, that kind of stuff is really important, and helping them understand what it is important to stand up for people in conversation.
Yeah. Autumn, you get the last word here. What are you thinking about as, you know, this hour comes to a close, but certainly not this conversation that we're having nationally parts, and culturally.
I mean, parts two, three, and four.
You're right.
Come back tomorrow. I think that it's the deprogram, the daily deprogramming of ourselves as women, who are the majority of the people who are experiencing this, as men, and with our kids every day, is the daily deprogramming and making it an important conversation to have, and not taking it for granted that the next generation of adults already understands this and knows how to, you know, knows what's happening, and will be able to dismantle this culture of misogyny, because we have to do the work, and we have to do it every day, and we have to do it all the time, and we have to do it everywhere.
Isn't that exhausting?
It is exhausting, and I think women are exhausted, and I think that whole piece about you know, you don't owe an explanation, and also that piece of, you know, all of our lives, everybody has given us their emotions to carry, and then when we express our emotions, we're being overly emotional and hypersensitive and dramatic. You know, that also has to end. That parallels this, which could of course be another show. It is exhausting, and that's why it has to be shared work. It has to be shared among men and women and everybody, and considered all the layers.
Well, I appreciate all three of you and so many of our listeners thinking about this, engaging with us today. Autumn Spencer is a writer and comedian. She writes a column for Kids VT and is a regular host of The Moth. Jessica Leahy is a teacher and writer. Her book is called The Gift of Failure, How the Best Parents Learn to Let Go So Their Children Can Succeed. Mark Nash is a psychotherapist and former director of the Vermont Stage Company. Thank you very much, all three of you.
Thank you.
That's it for today. Tomorrow, the story of a teacher and a pupil who both now have books on the short list for the National Book Award for Young People's Literature. We'll hear from Vermont College of Fine Arts professor and her student, who are both up for this prestigious writing award. That's tomorrow at noon. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.